Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second.
Get ultimate protection and durability for your painting project at Menards. Get a paint that combines durability and gorgeous color. Dutch Boy's DuraClean Interior Paint and Primer in 1 offers Stay Clean technology, making your home stay beautiful and clean longer. And with Dutch Boy's easy opening smooth pouring container, transforming your home has never been easier. Save big money on Dutch Boy paints and head into Menards to get your paint project started today.
Save big money at Menards.
Hello, listeners of Fully Booked. Our podcast network, Podcast One, has a brand new app for you to discover the show. Find out everything about your favorite Podcast One shows, including Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, through the all-new Podcast One app available now in the App Store or on Google Play. Find links to articles, social media, make playlists with your favorite episodes, and connect with other Fully Booked fans. You can even create your own polls for the latest book releases. We have our own little community on there. Check out exclusive content such as behind-the-scenes photos and so much more. And if you have 360-degree video or watch a bunch of shows in virtual reality, there's over 1,000 videos on the app right now. It's like you're in the studio. There is no other podcast app like this one. Download the all-new Podcast One app in the App Store or on Google Play today.
Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller list, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
And she said to him, "Roy, you know you wouldn't have waited on me for 7 years." And he said, "I don't know what you're talking about. This wouldn't have happened to you in the first place." And I was intrigued.
An American Marriage by Tiare Jones is the story of Celestial and Roy, a promising young couple living and loving in modern Atlanta. The two are joined in matrimony for merely 18 months when a wrongful conviction rips them apart. Kirkus calls An American Marriage a love story warped by racial injustice, subtle, well-crafted, and powerful. Last October, Oprah called Jones. She'd chosen An American Marriage as the first Oprah's Book Club pick of 2018. Jones is the author of 3 previous novels, Leaving Atlanta, The Untelling, and the bestseller Silver Sparrow, a National Endowment of the Arts Big Read Library book. She teaches in the MFA program at Rutgers Newark and is a visiting fellow at the Black Mountain Institute at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Welcome, Tiare Jones, to Fully Booked. So you're no stranger to having a book out in the world. This is your 4th novel. But I get the impression that this experience might be a little bit different.
Yeah, a little bit.
What have these last weeks, last months been like for you?
It actually started back in October.
What?
Yes, I was driving my car, just an ordinary day, and I've got a phone call, and I put it through. You know how you have your phone attached to the sound system in your car? So it's coming through all the speakers. A voice said, "Hi, this is Oprah."
No.
Yes, and this is, you know, months before the book came out.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. That's exactly what I said, except I said it over and over and over.
And she must get that a lot.
You know, I think so, because she calmly waited for me to, you know, cycle through all the reactions. And then she says, "Okay," like, "Okay, enough." And she asked me if I would, you know, that she wanted to use my book for her book club. And what did I think about it?
And so that launched what has now become a full-blown book tour. Where are you in the world right now?
I am at this moment. I looked around. I'm in Washington, D.C. But I'm going to Baltimore. I'm in Washington, D.C. to do some media, and then I'll go to Baltimore tonight. Then I'll come back to D.C. tomorrow, and then the next day I'll go to Savannah.
I am tired just hearing about that. What's harder work for you, writing the actual book or being celebrated and promoted in this way?
You know, I think that this tour is harder because I'm accustomed to writing books, and, you know, writers, we're kind of martyrs. You know, we sit in our rooms alone and we just toil away in our little factory of one, and that's our zone. This whole thing going out, and I've had to learn how to just to say thank you I feel like I know a lot about planting seeds, but I have no real experience with the harvest.
Wow.
I feel like I don't even have like the bag that you put the harvest in. It's all new.
Well, you got to get the bag. You got to check. You got to check under your seat for the bag.
it's really an amazing experience.
I'm really happy and excited for you, and I'm happy and excited to have the opportunity and the privilege to speak with you today about this gorgeous novel, An American Marriage. Would you please tell our listeners what An American Marriage is about?
An American Marriage is a novel about a young couple, Celestial and Roy, and they've only been married 18 months. I mean, her dad is still paying for the wedding when her husband is arrested and wrongfully incarcerated for, you know, a crime he simply did not do. He was just misidentified, and he's given a 12-year sentence, and they've only been married 18 months.
I remember there's an image, I think, from Celestial's perspective. It was only 18 months. I was still combing the rice from my hair.
Yes, they're still counting the time in months like you do with the baby.
You've chosen an epigraph for this novel by poet and essayist Claudia Rankine, and it's, "What happens to you doesn't belong to you, only half concerns you. It's not yours only." Why did you choose it?
I was having a real crisis in the novel because when I first wrote it, I was writing it from the point of view of Celestial because I was really interested in the way her husband's incarceration affected her. And I wrote the novel all the way through from her point of view, but it didn't feel complete. It was clear that it wasn't the whole story. And I went to hear Claudia read. She's a friend of mine. And I had read Citizen, you know, on the page, but when she read it aloud, I knew that I had the answer as to how to restructure the novel. I didn't even stay for the reception. I went right home to look at the manuscript again.
Wow, the power of art.
Yes, I mean, well, she's a genius. I think being around a genius is good for all of us.
So I was thinking about how this interview certainly doesn't belong just to the interviewer. And I wanted to know, I know you've been interviewed a lot and you're hitting the ground running and you're doing a lot of events. What do you want to talk about? Or what do you wish got more airtime in interviews about this novel?
To say that I have been delighted with the interviews that I've done, I've been interviewed by a lot of really smart young people, which are making me really optimistic about the world. I mean, the young people, they want to talk a lot about many issues at once. And that was my biggest fear with this novel, because I think it's about a lot of things. I think it is about wrongful incarceration and the ripple effects of mass incarceration. But it's also about gender and about marriage and the ways that marriage has or has not aged well as times have changed. And I'm really grateful that I haven't been put in a position where I had to choose what theme was the theme that drove the novel.
Yeah. I heard in other coverage that you wanted to write a story dealing with the issues of the day. How did this novel differ from your first three?
You know, my first three novels, I really wrote novels about family dynamics. And I think I resisted writing a novel about the issues of the day because I felt that as an African-American novelist, there was so much pressure on me to write a novel that could be used for sociological work. Mm-hmm. And I really resisted it I just wanted to assert the right to write a novel about a family and say, this is a novel about a black family and it is literature. It doesn't have to be doing kind of overt cultural work in that way, if that makes any sense. Because I do believe that stories about family do cultural work, but not in the way that was expected of me. Mm-hmm. But after I had written three novels, I felt like I guess I had proved whatever I needed to prove to myself. And I decided to engage, you know, just to take on society in a different kind of way. And so I chose the idea of mass incarceration because I've always been aware of it as a menace. I didn't have a kind of aha moment. I feel that for me, at least, growing up in Atlanta and having a very large extended family, that mass incarceration is in the air. Like if you live in Florida, tornado. I mean, hurricanes are out there. You know, it's just part of the landscape. And so I went to Harvard to do I got a fellowship at the Radcliffe Institute, and I did all this research on incarceration. And I was outraged, but I wasn't inspired. Because to write a novel, I have to be kind of delighted by the characters. And I didn't have characters. I had a problem, but no people.
Yeah. So how'd you get the people?
I overheard some people arguing in the mall. I am a nosy person. I fully admit that. I am nosy. And I was in the mall, and I saw this woman. She was beautifully dressed, cashmere coat, the belt. I remember the belt. It was beautiful. Mm. And the guy, he looked fine. He didn't look bad, but he didn't look like her. And she said to him, "Roy, you know you wouldn't have waited on me for 7 years." And he said, "I don't know what you're talking about. This wouldn't have happened to you in the first place." And I was intrigued because I didn't know him, but I felt fairly confident that he wouldn't have waited on her for no 7 years, as she said.
Boy.
But he was right. It probably wouldn't have happened to her. And I know that I have a novel when both characters in the conflict, when everyone is right.
It's interesting. There's a million different directions for us to go in, but one word you mentioned was expectation, specifically expectations on you as a novelist. I'd love it if we could talk a little bit about the expectations on your characters and how they differ so greatly. Starting with Celestial, what's expected of her as the wife in this marriage to Roy?
Celestial and I know she's not real. I don't want to sound like one of those crazy artists. I know she's not real, but that's said, Celestial and I grew very close during the writing of this novel because I felt that she and I were facing the same expectation. Oh. As the wife, she is expected to be faithful as Penelope in the Odyssey.
Mm.
You know, like it's supposed to be 400 BC for her all the time. And I felt, and that she should, you know, fight to free her man, that should be the only thing she does with her life, is to be a monument to his struggles and do everything she does should be centered around him, even though she's a very talented artist and her career is taking off. And I felt like for me as the writer, there was a lot of pressure for me to make this book only about Roy. And I wanted this book to be about both of them. So I felt that she and I were both struggling for her to deeply love Roy, but also love herself and her own dreams.
Our critic calls out in a very enthusiastic starred review that scene in the courtroom where she does stand up for him and she serves as a witness, a character witness. And I'd love to talk a little bit about what's going on in that scene for you.
Well, she loves him. They're newlyweds, and she's called to testify on his behalf. And the lawyer is telling her, you know, don't be so reserved. Don't be so articulate. You know, you want to show everyone why you married him. You need to be real. And, you know, she is a black woman. She's from a middle-class background where she's always told, you know, you have to be twice as good to get half as much. You have to be very polished, very refined. You have to be perfect. She doesn't know how to be vulnerable in front of strangers, and she's not down home. She's not folksy, and she doesn't know how to switch gears in that way, and she just feels like she fails him because of that. But I feel that she was in a position where she couldn't win. I think if she were less sophisticated, less refined, that in its own way would impugn her character. So I don't know that she could win. I mean, do you remember the young lady that testified at George Zimmerman's trial for killing Trayvon Martin?
Yes, I do.
And she was not sophisticated or refined, you know? And she was, then her character was impugned because she didn't have flawless grammar. She didn't have that kind of educated effect. So I feel that there was really no space for Celestial really to argue on Roy's behalf, but she did the best she could.
I know. And what's so heartbreaking and shocking is that, you know, at that point, by the time you reach the trial, these are people plugged into a system, you know, that, you know, is geared up to be suspicious of black men and to take the authority of white men, the prosecutors and the judges and often the jury, on say-so.
Yes, and they're just, and Celestial and Roy, you know, these are a couple, they're on the way up in the world, as my students say. You know, they're on the come up.
Yeah.
She's an artist. Her whole life is ahead of her. He is like a businessman, which has always been his fantasy. He's from a small town, and now he's moved to the big city of Atlanta. He's got this good job, and everything is just snatched from him.
Yeah. His is the first perspective we receive in the book, and it starts out, there are two kinds of people in the world, those who leave home and those who don't. I'm a proud member of the first category.
Yes,
and
he left home on the first thing smoking, like less than 3 days after graduation.
And it would have been sooner if, you know, he could have caught some transportation a little bit earlier. Yeah.
Yes.
You know, this is a young man with ambition. He has availed himself of every Head Start program. He has, you know, walked the line, and he finds his way all to college. He's going places.
And in an instant, it is taken away. An instant. Like, just imagine how he would feel just recounting all the details of his day. If only I hadn't helped the lady at the ice maker. If only I had stayed at my parents' instead of staying at a hotel. Just second-guessing little things, because what happened to him, it wasn't his fault. So he has no choice but to grasp at straws of details.
It's pretty much cut and dried. Everybody, save one minor character, arguably, recognizes this as an, you know, a completely wrong conviction. You know, they trust him. They believe him. This is wrong. He didn't do it.
Right. And that actually turned out to be another challenge in creating this book because, you know, as I love to say, you know why they call it wrongful incarceration? Because it's wrong. And when things are wrong, you don't have much room for the ambiguity that a novel requires.
Yeah.
But I felt that because his guilt or innocence wasn't even a subject of debate in the novel, it could allow us to turn our eye to this American marriage between Celestial and Roy. It let them be the stars of their own story. I didn't want to write a story starring the system.
Yeah.
I wanted to write about these two young people and their very vulnerable hearts.
It's interesting because in the second chapter, you introduce Celestial's perspective. And this begins, memory is a queer creature, an eccentric curator. I still look back on that night, although not as often as I once did. How long can you live with your face twisted over your shoulder? But I didn't forget, no matter what people may say. And the point is, people may say a lot, especially, specifically, when it comes to the subject of Celestial and Roy's marriage. Everybody has an opinion about that, it seems.
Everyone has an opinion. Her parents have her mother has an opinion. Her father has an opinion. His mother has all the opinions. And it's all based, I think, on the way people think a marriage should be. And all of these characters in their own marriages have bent the rules. They have made their own standards for what makes a union solid and sound. But when it comes to Celestial, everybody wants to lean on very old traditions, and no one considers her feelings at all. Her feelings are irrelevant, actually.
Yeah.
And I think her father even says that. It's not about what you feel.
And it's not, you know, she has opinions too. She's one half of this whole, and she has ideas about what a marriage is and what a marriage isn't. At one point, in one of her chapters, you write, a marriage is more than your heart, it's your life, and we are not sharing ours.
You know, and that is true. She is, like, she's a young woman in the prime of life. She's, what, like 25 when he's arrested?
Mm-hmm.
And she's to have a husband that she has only lived with for a few months, and to believe this is her husband, she doesn't feel like a married person.
Yeah.
And Roy, he is deeply invested in the marriage because it's all he has. And he's invested in the marriage as his memory has curated it. You know, she has become an idea to him more than, I think, the person that she is.
A significant part of this book is told through letters, which is really kind of a cool contrast with how fresh and current it feels as a story. I mean, brava.
Well, thank you. Well, I write letters in real life, and I just want you to know that nobody writes me back. But I write maybe 4 or 5 letters a week. I write my mother a letter every Sunday morning.
Oh, my gosh. You are a good daughter.
I just love it as a way to communicate. I think it's much more thoughtful than email. Like, I sit here in the afternoons since I'm on the road and I answer all the emails I've received during the day, and I kind of pound them out. But when I write a letter, it takes me time, and it's just more thoughtful. So it works better in a novel, because as a person reading a novel, you want to read thoughtful things.
Absolutely. And it really got me thinking about the difference between first-person narration and, you know, having the actual letter. Like, is that an even more limited perspective? Or
It is. And also, I felt like the letters really showed how little space, like, you know, letters are written usually on small paper, how little space they had to make their relationship. He even says about his pen, he says, look at this, he's looking at the pen thinking, this is all I have to be a husband with, but here I am trying. So they tried, but they just had these small pieces of paper to try and reflect their feelings and to the extent they could, their lives. So I felt like it worked both metaphorically and literally.
So who's Andre?
Andre is Celestial's oldest friend. She has known him since they were two little babies taking a bath together in the sink. And during the course of Roy's incarceration, you know, they have begun to see each other in a new way. He's been in love with her since they were babies in the sink. But as, you know, things, they've grown close during this time, and now they are a couple.
All right. I'm glad. I was waiting for it. I didn't want to, like, go there if you considered it a spoiler.
You know, I have thought, really, some people say, oh, you tell too much, but I feel that if you don't know that the plot is that Roy gets out and wants to resume their life together, I think that if you think this is a novel only about prison, one, I probably wouldn't read it, and I'm the one that wrote it. You know, I feel like the story is much more interesting to talk about when the reader in advance understands that the majority of the book happens once he comes out of prison with his key ring. He's got the key to his job, but he knows he doesn't have that job. He's got the key to his car. Where is that car? But he has the key to the house he shared with her. And that's what he holds on to in his heart.
I also get the impression as your reader that you wouldn't be much interested in a book that was completely devoid of humor.
No, I think this book is a little funny. Don't you think it's a little bit funny?
It is. It is. I think Roy is funny. I think it's more than a little bit.
His cellmate is hilarious. And that is a spoiler, ma'am, so we're going to leave that right there. But
okay.
Yes, the book is kind of funny, because I feel that if you were going to write about, well, anyone really, but it's so important that Roy, Celestial, and Andre, that they be more than their suffering. I think that sometimes as writers, we want to show characters suffering in order to build sympathy for them, but you don't want your characters just to be objects of pity. You want them to be full human beings. And life is funny. Funny things happen to everyone. Even someone who's in prison experiences funny things. And I don't even believe in that, oh, you have to laugh to keep from crying, because that makes it seem like your life is all misery and your laughter is contrived. I think you just laugh sometimes because it's funny.
From the moment Roy says, if my childhood were a sandwich, there would be no meat hanging off the bread, I was in love with him. Yeah.
Yeah. He's a charmer. He's a little bit of a rascal, but he's a charmer. He's such. And also, Roy is so deeply loved. I mean, I know that because in the novel he's wrongfully incarcerated, it's very easy to think that the world is against him. But everyone Roy has ever met, from his mother to his stepfather to his French teacher in high school to the girl who went to high school with him who he runs into as soon as he gets out of prison, everyone he meets is in love with him.
I love him.
He's a treasured person.
He is. He is a character who lives for me. They all are. Celestial, Andre, this is a beautiful book. And I thank you for the experience of reading it.
Well, thank you for calling me. This was fun.
So she's driving down the road and Oprah comes on Bluetooth. Is that what I'm to understand?
First of all, I'm always impressed by somebody who has a modern car that allows to listen to your phone on the speakers. But can you even imagine?
I know. It's like every writer's dream. It's so amazing.
Yeah. And she's, I'm sure in many ways that is like so overwhelming, and she is handling it all with grace. And this is one that makes me smile, Clay. This novel, I don't know if you've had a chance to read it yet, but it is truly excellent.
It is. And it's just a great publishing story.
Yeah.
Some nice success for her.
The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books right here on Fully Booked.
Get ultimate protection and durability for your painting project at Menards. Get a paint that combines durability and gorgeous color. Dutch Boy's DuraClean Interior Paint and Primer in 1 offers Stay Clean technology, making your home stay beautiful and clean longer. And with Dutch Boy's easy opening smooth pouring container, transforming your home has never been easier. Save big money on Dutch Boy paints and head into Menards to get your paint project started today.
Save big money at Menards.
Hi, this is Eric Bigger from The Bachelorette, here to tell you about my new show, Bigger Talks, exclusively on Podcast One. Every week, I will be here with my guests, taking a deeper look into subcultures of American life, from relationships to race to gender to sexuality. We're highlighting the strength of diversity. So please join me every Wednesday for Bigger Talks with me, Eric Bigger, right here on Podcast One. Download and listen to new episodes exclusively at PodcastOne.com, the new Podcast One app, or subscribe on Apple Podcasts.
This is Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Thanks for joining us.
I'm going to talk to Mark Updegrove.
Great.
About his new book, The Last Republicans, and I will tell you about him. Mark Updegrove is the author of 4 books on the American presidency, including his latest, The Last Republicans, Inside Their Extraordinary Relationship Between George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush, a book that broke news for its revelations about what the Bush presidents think about our current president. He's the former director of the LBJ Presidential Library and the current president and CEO of the LBJ Foundation. Welcome to the show, Mark. So you started this book, I think, when you were working at the LBJ Presidential Library. Had you wanted to sort of cross the aisle and write about the Bush presidents for a while?
Very much so. You know, there are so many misconceptions about the Bushes, and in particular about that relationship between George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush. When George W. Bush was in the White House, there was a great speculation about what was going on between the two, particularly when the younger Bush, Bush 43, decided to wage war against Iraq, something his father had pointedly not done after our victory in the Gulf War. So, and you'd be in these cocktail conversations, you know, with a bunch of people at parties, and they would speculate about the Shakespearean machinations between the two of them.
Right.
And I thought, well, you know, before the elder Bush becomes too old, that story has to come out, and it has to come from them.
Yeah. And so, I mean, access is a crucial question in a book like this. Was it easy to get them to agree to talk to you, and how did you make that happen?
Well, they're famously circumspect.
Yeah.
They're maybe some of the least introspective people you'll meet, and they're also very wary of psychobabble. And so to explore the father-son relationship was something neither of them really wanted to do, but I think they too felt the importance of getting the story out for the sake of history. So I had gotten the okay from the elder Bush, Bush 41, but on the condition that the younger Bush, Bush 43, cooperate as well. And that one I was worried about. And I went up to Dallas, and he and I had a very quick meeting in which he said, I've decided this story needs to be told, and I've decided that you're the one to do it. So I was very pleased that I got that kind of access and the opportunity to tell a story like this.
Yeah. And so you mentioned people sort of guessing that there were these Shakespearean machinations. How do you describe the relationship between the two of them? I mean, was it always as complex as sort of a Shakespearean machination would suggest?
I don't think it's as complex as people think it is. It's a love story, first and foremost. And I think the Bush 43 has great reverence for his father. Everybody in the Bush family does. it was a little more complicated for him. He was the oldest. He was saddled with his father's name and with it the expectations that were inherent in being a George Bush. He was 6 years older than his next oldest sibling, Jeb, although he had a sister who was 3 years younger who died when he was young. A young boy. So there was a lot that was thought about Bush that was not true. One of the great misconceptions is that George W. Bush was not the political heir apparent to his father, that they had all thought that Jeb would succeed the father in the business of politics. And while I think there was great confidence that Jeb would could make his mark in the world of politics, George W. Bush had made a very credible run for Congress in 1978, which very few people remember. He had gotten the Republican nomination against all odds and ran a very tight race against Kent Hance, the Democrat who won it in a very heavily Democratic district. So his father saw that and thought, boy, he has real ability. And when he ran for when the elder Bush ran for the presidency in 1988, he really went to George W. Bush as a trusted advisor, the most trusted, I think, in the family, with the possible exception of Barbara Bush.
Yeah. But, you know, I was really interested to learn in the book that apparently, I mean, as opposed to, say, the Kennedys or, of course, the Adams from earlier American history, the only other family that had a father and son as presidents, that George H.W. Bush didn't really push forward this sort of family propaganda that we're a political family and that you must go into politics. Is that right?
That's exactly right. I think he was very pleased that both of his sons went into politics, but two of his sons, Jeb and George W. But there wasn't an expectation. And I think you're right. There wasn't this, you know, Joe Kennedy, you're going to be president, and Jack, you're going to support Joe. And then when Joe dies, no, Jack, you're going to be president. And, you know, there wasn't these grand ambitions or this great legend that the Bushes spun about themselves. If they had any expectations of the children, they were quiet. And if the children did feel those expectations, they were self-imposed, but they saw in their father this great example of who they should be, and they followed that model.
Yeah. So how often would the older Bush advise his son when the younger Bush was president?
That was the $64,000 question, Clay. You know, everyone wanted to know that. And as a historian, that's what you really want to know. The answer is very little. The elder Bush is inherently humble, and I think it would not be in his nature to foist his opinion on his son and to say, hey, Junior, you're doing things all wrong here. Boy, you don't know this job at all. He also knew that, as George W. Bush told me, his father knew the job of president. He knew that there are inherent burdens with the job, and you don't want to add to the burden of the president. You want to create an environment in which that person can relax, a loving environment for a person who doesn't have a very loving job often. But he would also say that the world had changed after he stepped down from the Oval Office in 1993, ceding the office to Bill Clinton. We were in a very different time after 9/11 in particular. And while the elder Bush was given intelligence briefings, as an intrinsic part of being a former president, that the intelligence apparatus always gives our former presidents briefings, he wasn't as up to speed on the world as his son was. So he was very reluctant to give his opinion, although when asked, would certainly proffer it.
Yeah, yeah. So there's this moment in the book when Hosni Mubarak, the former Egyptian dictator, tried to influence George W. by referencing his friendship with the older Bush president. How did that go down?
Not very well. Not very well. You know, the speculation we have around the elder Bush's influence on his son is around Iraq. But you're right. I think there was much greater interaction between the two on the Middle East in particular. I think the Bush 43 was far more pro-Israel than his father was. Hosni Mubarak asked the father to deliver a message to George W. Bush, and he sort of said, go easier on me in Egypt. And George W. Bush said, no, I don't care what he says. I don't care if you know my father. It doesn't mean anything to me. And he put the arm on Mubarak to hold free and fair elections in Egypt. And he said it, you know, when he did, look what happened at the cost of resisting the democratic process. He got thrown out of office. And so he saw that as a vindication of his policy with Egypt.
So it was revealed in the New York Times right before this book was published, I think, that you got the Bush presidents to confirm that they hadn't voted for President Trump. And I think the word they used about him is, quote, blowhard. We talked a little bit about sort of getting access to them and just getting them, first of all, to agree to let you interview them. But getting them to confess that those things is a little bit sort of deeper access. Tell me about, you know, getting to know them and getting them to be comfortable with, you know, with being honest with you.
I think, you know, you have a great responsibility when folks give you the kind of access that Presidents George W. Bush and George H.W. Bush give you, you have a responsibility to tell that story fairly and even-handedly. And I think that they gained a certain trust with me through this process. I hope that they did, and I hope that they see the book as a fairly representing their story. The Trump stuff was really interesting because you could infer how the Bushes felt or would feel about Donald Trump, but to have them say it directly was quite a revelation. George H.W. Bush said that Donald Trump was a blowhard. He didn't like him. There were a couple of stories that come out in the book that show that he didn't like him well before Donald Trump was even remotely a presidential contender. And I learned recently that after the news was broke about George Bush 41 saying that Trump was a blowhard, that according to Merriam-Webster, the word blowhard spiked in searches by 94,000%.
Wow.
But there's a wonderful story, if I can, about that shows how the elder Bush felt about Donald Trump again well before Trump had entered the world of politics. And it was in the mid-90s when George H.W. Bush was having his private plane maintained at an airport in Boston. And an attendant came to his chief of staff and indicated that Donald Trump was about to land and would the former president like to meet Mr. Trump? So Bush's chief of staff dutifully brought him this proposition, and he was reading a newspaper and he had it in front of his face, and he pulled it down and he said, "God, no." And then he put up the newspaper again and then brought it down again and said, whoa, wait a minute, is he walking this way? And she said, "I don't know." And so he put up his paper again to shield his face in the event that Donald Trump came and might recognize him. So that was a pretty good reflection of his feelings about Trump. And if you know the Bush family, humility is an inherent part of who they are. So they were bound not to to be attracted to a Donald Trump.
Yeah, yeah. But was it difficult to get them to admit that they hadn't voted for Trump, or did you have to really push on that front?
You know, I asked the question and they answered it. I think one of the things George W. Bush said that he was concerned. Now, bear in mind, too, Clay, that I asked these questions prior to Donald Trump becoming president. This is a reflection of how they felt during the election cycle of 2016. I think it's fair to assume that they still feel this way. But I think they would be very reluctant to directly criticize a president. They revere the office, and I think they root for any successor, Republican or Democrat. But George W. Bush said when Donald Trump, during the campaign of 2016, when he said, "I am my own advisor," George W. Bush said, "This guy doesn't know what it is to be president." You can't know everything. No man is omniscient, particularly with as president. You have so many things on your desk at any given time. You have to rely on those around you to advise you on the best course of action. And you rely on your own abilities as a decider to figure out the best course.
Yeah. No, there's that great book by Chris Whipple. We've had him on the podcast, The Gatekeepers.
Sure.
And it's this history of the chiefs of staff since the Nixon administration. And one thing that book definitely shows you is that taking advice wisely from a chief of staff and from really all of president's advisors is really the only way to go. And it does not really seem like that's happening so much in the Trump administration, I guess.
No, but nor do you have a president who is briefing, who is self-briefing. He's not reading the intelligence that's coming his way. He's making decisions based on very cursory knowledge of anything. I think based on his ostensibly preternatural confidence in his ability to collate information and make decisions.
But George W. Bush takes his role as the eldest son really seriously because he got angry at his father's former chief of staff for not coming to him first with the news that his mother was sick, right?
Absolutely. And what happened was, this was at some point early in the George W. Bush presidency, Gene Becker, who's the chief of staff of George H.W. Bush, called Marvin, one of the Bush sons, to let him know that Barbara Bush had an illness which had not been diagnosed, but it was leaving her feeling pretty poorly. And then there was some concern about what it was and how it would manifest itself further. And 5 minutes after getting off the line with Marvin, she gets a call unsolicited from the White House. And there's George W. Bush on the line, and he's hot. He's angry. He said, "Why didn't you come to me?" And she said, "Well, Mr. President, you are the leader of the free world. I'm not going to come to you with something like this. I might go to Andy Card, his chief of staff, or somebody else on the staff, but I'm not going to come to you with something like this." And he said, "No, no, you will come to me. I'm the oldest son. You will come to me, and you'll come to me first." He was the president, but he never stopped being the first son.
Yeah. But, you know, at the same time, I mean, you state that the younger Bush never really felt any pressure to live up to his father's achievements. And you quote George W.'s friends saying, you know, things to that effect. And so there's no reason to doubt what his friends are saying in the book, but it does seem so hard. Did you find that hard to believe? Because I found it.
Well, I don't think that those pressures that he felt, Clay, were self-imposed. I don't think there's any doubt that he felt the need to prove himself in some capacity.
Yeah.
But they weren't foisted on him by his dad. His dad didn't say, you know, you need to do this or you need to do that. The amazing thing about the father is the father never lost faith in his son. The father was auspicious very early in life and had a remarkable record of achievement by the time he turned 30. George W. Bush didn't do much until he was in his 40s. He didn't really come into his own. A little wild. I think that might be overblown too, a little bit, but certainly a little wild and a little reckless, and very much, while not, you know, not a hippie of the 1960s, gave himself sort of Aquarian freedoms of that time by letting him find himself in his 20s. He kind of was very nomadic during that period in his life, and he went from job to job and place to place, very unrooted, very unmoored to any specific ambition or task. And he allowed himself that time to find himself. And ultimately he did. And his father, importantly, never said, "Hey, what are you doing here, pal? Right. You know, you got to get in line. You got to start doing stuff." So he had faith that his son would find his way. And indeed he did.
Yeah. So what is next for the Bush family? I mean, obviously Jeb ran for president. That did not work out. But his son, George P. Bush, is the Texas Land Commissioner. Is he making bigger moves? Or,
well, the book ends with an epilogue, a very brief epilogue, that features George P. Bush as sort of the next generation of Bushes who may be a political force at some point. George P. Bush was the only member of the Bush family who endorsed Donald Trump. And I think he did so as a political pragmatist, as somebody who was a rising star in the party, didn't want to distance himself too much by not endorsing Trump. He was very resistant early on when his father, of course, was running against Trump. But when it became inevitable that Donald Trump was the presidential nominee of his party, he got in line. And I think that the Bush family accepted that. And one of the things that George H.W. Bush is did for his sons is he said, "Look, forge your own path. No one will ever question your love or loyalty in this family. Sometimes you've got to do stuff that is going to distance yourself from me. Well, when you do that, feel free to do it." Mm-hmm. And that's exactly, I think, what was going through George P. Bush's mind when he made that very tough decision to endorse Donald Trump.
Yeah. So obviously, as I mentioned, you've written about American presidents before. What are you going to write about next?
You know, I think that the story of Bill Clinton is one that needs to be told. I'd love to get access to Bill Clinton. I'd love to hear his story. And I think that there is enough distance between his presidency and current day that we can get a more objective view. I mean, the Clintons have always been political lightning rods. Obviously, Hillary Clinton still is. And because of her link to Bill Clinton, there's still some inability to look at him objectively. But I think we're starting to see the forest for the trees with his administration. And it's time for another look.
Yeah. And the players in that administration are still alive.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And you can get the accounts from them as well. And I think, you know, that relationship, just as I delved into the relationship, very important for historical reasons between George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush. I think it's important to tell the story of the relationship between Bill and Hillary Clinton. And I have a feeling mm-hmm. there are a lot of misconceptions about that one as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, cool. Congrats on the book, The Last Republicans. It's a great read, and thanks for stopping by the studio.
Always good to see you, Clay. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Clay, that seems to prove that access is everything. Even if your subjects don't particularly want you around, if you stay long enough, you're bound to get something good.
It's so true. I mean, I think they liked Mark perfectly well, but and it sounds like they sort of wanted to make their feelings known about our current president. But no, I mean, that's the great virtue of this book, is it just, there's all these great details that really hadn't been written about before. So anyone who wants to know more about the Bushes, The Last Republicans is your book.
I hope he gets that Clinton access. I would love to read that one too.
Yeah, I think he would do a great job with that. I mean, there's so much drama in that administration, and he's right that it is time to sort of tell that story. So should we call up the editors and see which books, which bestsellers they think are the best?
I've been waiting all week. We're now joined by our Kirkus editors for their suggestions on what you might want to pick up this week in books. We have Laura Simeon, our YA editor, Lori Muchnick, our fiction editor, Eric Liebetrau, managing and nonfiction editor, and Vicki Smith, children's editor. Hey, Lori, what's up in fiction this week?
We've got a good one this week. It's a book called Munich by Robert Harris. He is a British writer who's written a bunch of different thrillers set at different, a lot of them are historical and they're set at different periods, but he particularly likes sort of World War II era. He wrote Fatherland, which was about what would happen if Germany had won the war, and takes off from there. His new one, Munich, takes place at the Munich Conference in 1938, when Hitler was threatening to invade part of Czechoslovakia. And so he met with the British Prime Minister Chamberlain in Munich to try to work things out. History hasn't looked very kindly on Chamberlain, who kind of appeased Hitler and signed an agreement with him. Harris has a slightly more positive view of Chamberlain. He thinks that he was kind of a shrewd operator who was doing his best to postpone things because the British Army wasn't really ready to fight Hitler yet. But the main characters are two lower level, you know, there are all these real life characters in here, but the main characters are two fictional lower level people, one German aide to Hitler and one British aide to Chamberlain, who were old friends because they went to Oxford together years ago. And the German guy doesn't want them to sign this agreement, the Munich Agreement, because he is part of a plot to try to assassinate Hitler. And he thinks that it would get in the way of that. So the two of them were sort of spying and passing each other secret papers and working together. And even though obviously World War II is kind of a big spoiler and we know what's going to happen, it's exciting and well-written and a fun book.
Well, I like spies, so I don't mind a little side helping of history with it.
Yeah.
Thanks, Lori.
Sure.
So, Laura, you just got back from the American Library Association's Midwinter Conference, is what that one is called. Tell us a little bit about what was happening there in the YA world and which YA books you think we should pay attention to.
Well, the big event of Midwinter is, of course, the Youth Media Awards. So Vicky and I were there in the audience, waiting with bated breath for the announcements. And I thought this year they did such a great job. They chose a lot of books that have, you know, excellent reader appeal and literary merit. Just this wonderful slate, you know, it's hard to narrow it down, but one I wanted to highlight was one of the Stonewall Honor books. It's The Gentleman's Guide to Vice and Virtue by Mackenzie Lee. And it's funny, it's historical fiction. It's a book that appeals to me personally because when I was in high school, my heartthrob was Lord Byron. And this is a book about two young men and the younger sister of one of them going on this grand tour of Europe, and they fall in love and they have adventures. And anyway, fantastic read and very unusual.
And so that award is for gay literature?
Yes, LGBT, yeah, LGBT experience. Yeah. Yep, exactly. And then the other one I just wanted to mention was Piecing Me Together by Renee Watson, mm-hmm. Which got a Newbery honor. And that is a book that's, it's sort of dear to me because it's a Pacific Northwest author. It's set in Portland, Oregon, and it's about the independent school world, which I also came from. And it's really, this just beautifully written book about the experience of an African-American girl attending a predominantly white independent school and just navigating these different worlds. So highly recommend that one.
Nice. Alrighty, thanks.
That sounds good. I too am set in Portland, Oregon, so I'm especially intrigued.
Yeah, they got to read it.
Hey, Vicky, how was your Midwinter experience? Did you find any gems?
Oh, well, yeah. Mostly it was celebrating gems that I already knew about, but I was highly delighted by the gems that were chosen. like Laura, I really appreciated the attention given to Piecing Me Together, but I won't repeat what Laura said. What was really interesting to me, the ALA Awards for years have been pilloried for being this sort of white people's club, and they have been more and more diverse as the years go by, and that is delightful to see. I think we were all kind of worried that it was just going to be a blip, but it really does seem to be taking hold, that the award committees are really looking hard about books by people of color and about experiences that are not normative. And the Newbery Committee did an especially good job because not a single one of their honorees is a typical one, or what we once might have thought of typical. The winner is a book called Hello Universe, and it's by a Filipino-American writer named Aaron Entrada Kelly. And it's got these three storylines about a Filipino-American boy, and his parents are not recent immigrants, but his parents are immigrants, so he's first generation. Then there's a third generation Japanese-American girl, and then there's another deaf girl, and all three of them have completely well-developed characters, and their storylines all intersect in unexpected ways. It's a lovely book. And one of the other Newbery books that I was particularly happy to see loved, I guess before I move on to that, I will say The Long Way Down by Jason Reynolds. And you know, mm-hmm. Jason Reynolds, it seems like he's just, you know, on a roll that's never going to stop. But he got a Newbery honor as well as other awards. But the book that I really was thrilled about is kind of an unassuming little book from a small press. It's called Crown, An Ode to the Fresh Cut. And the author is Derek Barnes and the illustrator is Gordon C. James. And it won a Newbery honor, a Caldecott honor, a Coretta Scott King author honor, and a Coretta Scott King illustrator honor. And as it kept on just turning up in the during the awards announcements, I was reminded of a note that the reviewer had sent to me last summer when we were working on the review, and it was, "I really loved it and want it to win all the awards, all of them." And it did. And it's such a fabulous book. I'm so excited that the Newbery Committee and all the other committees found it and saw how fabulous it is.
Yeah, that review caught my eye. I remembered the reviewer's enthusiasm. I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to interview the author.
Well, maybe for his next book.
Yeah.
So, Eric, what are we liking in nonfiction?
I'm going to go with the latest book by Dave Eggers called The Monk of Mocha. And it's a nonfiction book. And, of course, Eggers is known for his fiction and his nonfiction. I particularly like his nonfiction, like Zaytoun and other books like that. But this book is about a immigrant from Yemen who ends up bringing this coffee to the U.S. that eventually morphs into the company called Blue Bottle, which is, a lot of you may know that. It's an elite coffee chain in San Francisco, and it's growing rapidly, and some think that it could be the next Starbucks. Some suspect, and some also fear that eventuality. But the book is kind of a really good mix of biography of this really industrious Muslim man, a little capsule history of coffee and its development through the years, and how it's become both a mass commodity and a niche product. So it's got a good mix of stories. So there's also the adventure story of the man escaping from the civil war in a foreign country. And a reviewer said that Eggers gives his hero a lot of thematic baggage to carry, but it's hard to resist the derring do of the Horatio Alger of Yemenite coffee. And as always with Eggers, it's very well fluidly written, highly readable, and it got a star.
Awesome. Well, thank you. Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks, editors. So next week, we're going to be talking to Jason Matthews, bestselling thriller writer. His latest one is called The Kremlin's Candidate. It's a very timely thriller. Until then, you know what to do. Turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.
Hey, this is Jordan Harbinger. I used to host the Art of Charm podcast, but now it's time for something new. The Jordan Harbinger Show. Did you know you can be entertained and actually get a boost in your life at the same time? On this show, we dig into the superpowers of the world's most interesting thinkers and top talents. Then we deliver them to you right into your ears. But I get it. We're not all superheroes. That's why we give you their blueprint so you can live what you listen. After 1,000 interviews, learning 5 languages, and getting arrested in a country that doesn't even exist anymore, I'm now more ready than ever to introduce you to The Jordan Harbinger Show. Listen free to The Jordan Harbinger Show, available on Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and the Podcast One app.